Chapter 7. Steele listened intently while Higgins outlined the situation. Then he exhaled heavily.
Jesus Christ! Is there any chance he's bluffing? Do you think he'd really launch the missiles?
The Zach Cord I knew never bluffed, said Higgins grimly. He might have lost his mind, but I doubt he's lost his nerve.
Does he actually have the capability to do it?
The NSC seems to think he does. He's got everything out there that he needs. All the supplies and plenty of spare parts to get what's left of the network operational. Plus the people with the expertise to help him do it. Steele shook his head.
God damn! Has he issued his ultimatum yet?
He called the president a short while ago and presented his demands, said Higgins. His timing was perfect. He waited about an hour or so after he spoke to me. Just enough time for the president to get the NSC together in a emergency meeting. They were all there when Cord called. He's given us two options. Either we submit to him and execute an orderly transition of authority, or he goes public with the announcement that New York will be ground zero.
Good God! They'll throw the whole city into panic!
That's what he's counting on, said Higgins, nodding. He doesn't intend to use the missiles except as an absolute last resort. If Congress refuses to capitulate, he'll go on the air with his threat of nuclear blackmail and hope that a civil insurrection will result in the government being overthrown. And they'll do it too. We'll have the whole population of this city storming the federal building. The entire Congress is liable to get lynched. Higgins compressed his lips into a tight grimace. We've got 72 hours. That's how long Cord's given us before he goes on the air with his ultimatum.
That's if Linda Tellerman doesn't beat him to the punch, said Steele.
Don't worry. She won't. She won't be going on the air with anything. I had her placed under arrest earlier tonight. She's being held right here in the federal building.
You arrested her? Said Steele. On what charge?
Conspiracy to violate the National Security Act. She's being held without bail.
Can you make it stick?
I'm not interested in making the charge stick, said Higgins. I only want to keep her damn mouth shut until we can figure out what the hell to do. The network's lawyers are all having coronaries, but I've got the president's personal authority behind me. Miss Tellerman's not going anywhere.
Did she tell anyone else about this?
What, and take the chance of losing her exclusive? Higgins said wryly.
Yeah, that would be just like her. How did the media react to her arrest?
They ran with it as their lead on the 11 o'clock news, said Higgins. I've had reporters trying to get through to me all night, but we designated a spokesman to field all of their questions with no statement at this time, and hold them off with a promise of a press conference tomorrow morning.
What are you going to tell them?
As little as possible. Fortunately, it's not my headache. State's going to handle it. I've got enough to worry about as it is.
What about this sergeant, Tracy? Any further word from him?
Not yet, said Higgins. Tellerman wouldn't say where he was, so we shot her up with pentothal and asked her once again. His last location was some bar in Denver called the Crazy Horse Club, but he told her that if he didn't hear from her within an hour, he wasn't going to stick around. I called the club, but he'd already taken off. The police came by looking for him. Apparently, they spotted the truck he stole outside the club. Cord sent word to the Denver Strike Force that Tracy was an unstable individual who'd gone off the deep end and went AWOL while he was on guard duty with a full battle kit. Knowing that, the Denver cops will probably shoot first and ask questions later.
Can you back them off and give the kid some room?
Higgins shook his head. I'm afraid not. Cord sent a chopper out to intercept him, and Tracy shot it down with a rocket. Police found the wreckage on I-25 near Loveland. There weren't any survivors. So now, in addition to desertion, Tracy's also wanted for murder. If he's smart, he's found some place to hold up and stay low. If he tries to get in touch with Tellerman again, he'll find out she's been arrested, and you might try to get in touch with me. If he does, I'll try bringing him in. Otherwise, there's really nothing I can do for him, and I can't spend any time worrying about him now.
I don't suppose there's any way you evacuate the city.
Even if we could, Cord could just as easily target Chicago or Boston or any other well-populated city, Higgins said. We don't even know how many birds he's got out there.
Looks like he's got you over a barrel. 3 days. That's not a lot of time. What the hell can you do in 3 days?
There's only one thing we can do, Higgins said. Assault the base. That's where you come in.
You want me to assault an army base? You've got to be kidding. I may be super cop, but I'm not that good. What about the military?
With the exception of some local troops, none of the other units are responding. Steele frowned.
What do you mean they're not responding?
I mean we've got a damn mutiny on our hands, said Higgins. All of a sudden, all our units are engaged in hostilities out in the field, or there's been some kind of viral outbreak, or communications have mysteriously broken down. Cord must have gotten through to all the area commanders. They're sitting on their hands, waiting to see if he can pull it off. Even the joint chiefs are recommending that we go along with Cord.
Christ, said Steele. So what the hell do you expect me to do? Take on a whole damn base all by myself?
Of course not. That would be suicide. But I'd like you to take charge of the assault. You can use some local troops that have remained loyal, and I'll get you all the ordnance you'll need. I can give you all the agents and security personnel I've got at my disposal, and we can mobilize the strike force and the police department.
And leave the city unprotected! The gangs would have a goddamn field day, said Steele. Besides, word would get out in a flash and have the entire city in a panic.
I don't see what other choice we've got. Do you?
No, not really, said Steele. Hell, even if we could assault the base, what would prevent Cord from launching the missiles the moment we tried it?
Maybe nothing. But according to Linda Tellerman, Tracy told her that the missiles weren't fully operational yet. Cord might still be several days away from having them ready to launch. That could be the reason for the 72-hour deadline. Tracy forced him to move up the calendar. If we can hit them fast enough and hard enough.
You'd be taking one hell of a chance, said Steele.
I don't see any alternative. Our only chance is to hit the base and take out Cord before he can launch the birds. Without him, the whole thing will probably fall apart. It's either that or surrender the government to him.
What happens if you agree to capitulate?
Asked Steele.
It could buy us some time. You could go send some representatives out to negotiate with Cord, and when the assault came down, they could deny that the government had anything to do with it.
He'd never buy it.
He might, especially if he knows the military is playing a waiting game to see if he can pull it off. If we go in with choppers and heavy armor, he'll know that the government's behind it. But what if the base was hit by outlaw raiders?
Raiders? Said Higgins, frowning.
It's a long shot, said Steele. But if he buys it, it might just keep him from launching the missiles. Cord knows that there are several large, well-organized outlaw gangs in part of his part of the country, raiders who've hit federal arsenals and equipped themselves with ordnance. His troops have probably gone up against some of them. We can get a bunch of civilian vehicles together. 4x4s, trucks, jeeps, motorcycles, maybe a few stolen military deuces, get a few C-17s out of Newark, bring them to LaGuardia, load them up and fly them as low as possible, plotted to stay off radar. Take off at night and follow a flight path plotted to keep us well away from any military units out in the field so they can't spot us and send word ahead to Cord. We could set up an LZ within striking distance of the base and launch a mobile ground assault so it'll look like a large band of raiders trying to hit the base for ordnance and supplies.
I doubt he'd fall for that, said Higgins. Cord isn't stupid.
I'm not assuming he is, said Steele, which is why I'm thinking of using the real thing. We'll use all the soldiers and agents you can get, plus retired strike force personnel and cops, private security, anyone who we can drum up in a hurry, but I'm also talking about using real outlaws. Long hair, beards, colors, the works. There'll be no mistaking them for regular troops. We can salt the other people in among them.
You can't be serious.
Why not? Ice still has a lot of gang people who are loyal to him out in no man's land. And the Brood will do just about anything if the money's right. Hell, they're so hardcore crazy, they're liable to get off on something like this.
That's insane, said Higgins. You're talking about sending a bunch of untrained hoodlums and psychotics against some of the most finely disciplined troops in the entire world. That would be like sending the Hell Angels out to take out the Israeli army.
You got any other suggestions?
Higgins sighed and ran his hand through his hair. He looked exhausted. No, damn it, I don't. You think you can actually convince a bunch of outlaws to throw in with us?
I can try. It'll take some pretty strong incentives.
Yeah, I figured that. But I don't know how much we can spare up in a hurry. We can offer them ordnance, of course. Or what about drugs? You think they take a payoff in drugs?
You've got drugs!
Higgins grimaced. The kind of budget we've had to work with. We had to make ends meet somehow. Yeah, we got drugs.
Some outfit I'm working for, said Steele Riley. I spend half my life trying to put the pushers out of business, and here you are supplying them.
He shook his head with disbelief.
You're a real piece of work, Higgins.
Save me the sermon, okay? Will they take drugs in payment, or won't they?
What the hell do you think? The way things are these days, the damn drugs are more stable than the currency.
Okay, then. Get a hold of Ice. I'll see what I can come up with. You got any contacts with the Brood?
Not really, but I've crossed paths with a few of them before. I'll take a chopper out to Montauk and see if I can swing a deal with them.
Higgins nodded. Okay, get on with it. We need to move fast. We've only got 3 days. Christ, Cord's got Rangers, Delta Force, and Cobras, and we're going to send out a bunch of retired cops, scooter trash, and junkies to take them on. What a joke. They'll all get cut to ribbons.
Maybe,
Steele said. Maybe? What are you, kidding me?
They've had to learn how to survive out there in no man's land, where every day is a goddamn war,
said Steele.
They may not be trained to discipline troops, but I wouldn't write them off so quickly.
Yeah, well, playing cowboys and Indians with the cops is one thing, Higgins said. We're talking about taking on the Cobra Force, for Christ's sakes. Those guys are a fucking nightmare. I ought to know. I helped Cord train them.
They don't need to beat the Cobra Force, said Steele. Just keep them busy long enough for me to get inside the base and find Cord.
Higgins thought it over for a moment, then nodded. All right. What the hell? It's worth a shot. We haven't got a lot of options. It's your operation. You call it. What do you want me to do?
Start commandeering those vehicles and arranging transport,
Steele said.
And get your resources together. Cash, weapons, dope, whatever the hell you can get your hands on in a hurry. And stand by with choppers to deliver the goods. I won't be in a much position to negotiate. We don't have time to haggle with the warlords. Whatever the gangs want, we'll have to meet their price. Get as many trained personnel together as you can and tell them to dress casual. You know what I mean. No washing, no shaving. The rattier they look, the better. For the sake of security, you better not tell them any more than they need to know, but make sure they understand just how bad the odds are. I only want volunteers. We also need a staging area for the operation. A couple of large warehouses ought to do. Pick out something in no man's land to attract the least amount of attention. Take care of that first, so I can tell our people where to report.
Okay. I'll get on it right away.
I'll stop by my place, pick up my gear, coordinate with Ice, then head straight down to Montauk. Have Dr. Stone standing by on the broadcast link. I want to keep in touch.
Right. Good luck.
Yeah, you too. Who knows? If we can pull this off, they might even give you back your budget.
Higgins snorted. If we pull this off, they'll probably just give me a commendation and then retire me with a pension. Hell, I'd just as soon catch it from a bullet in Wyoming.
You mean you intend to come along?
Said Steele, surprised. Well, I'm sure as hell not going to sit around here and wait for Cord to drop a peacemaker in my lap, said Higgins. Besides, I've been behind this goddamn desk too long. It's past time I got my hands dirty again. Steele smiled.
Okay then, let's do it!
Stormy's place was on the top floor of a dilapidated three-story Victorian on Elizabeth Street. Actually, it was four floors up since it was located in the attic. At some point in the distant past, the houses had been divided into small apartments. A narrow stairway had been added, leading up to a small, finished loft in the attic. The interior of the roof had been insulated and covered with drywall, so that the walls were only about 4 feet high along the sides before they met the angles of the roof. The door opened into a small living room, which led into a tiny kitchenette, then a bathroom, located squarely in the middle of the loft. It was necessary to go through the bathroom door, walk through the narrow space between the plastic curtain, bathtub, shower in the sink, and toilet, then through another door to get into the bedroom at the rear end of the apartment. Stormy's bed consisted of an old mattress lying on the floor, with a couple of plastic milk crates placed on either side of it for nightstands. There were no carpets, except for a small, braided, oval throw rug in the front room. A worn and stained old futon served as a couch in the living room. And there was an old armchair, badly in need of reupholstering, with the legs either sawn off or broken off. There was an old coffee table with the finish almost completely worn off, some bookshelves made up of boards placed across stacks of old bricks, a desk that consisted of an old, hollow core door placed across two scratched and dented filing cabinets, a chair, a couple of small desk lamps, and several candles stuck in bottles or melted onto place on old, chipped plates. She had about a dozen or so clay pots with ivy growing in them to provide a touch of greenery, and most of her books were ancient, well-worn paperbacks, mostly fantasy and science fiction, with a sprinkling of mysteries. There were a number of old posters, thumbtacked to the sloping walls. One of a voluptuous, dark-skinned woman dressed in some kind of animal-skin bikini and furry boots, standing in a dramatic pose with her bare legs spread. Another depicted a pretty, androgynous-looking young black man with his hair and wavy little ringlets. He was in the act of singing, holding a microphone, his mouth open and his head thrown back. There was another print of a unicorn with its head in the lap of a young maiden in a long, diaphanous white gown, and several pen and ink sketches that either Stormy or one of her friends had done, drawings of elves, wizards, and topless female centaurs. They were rather good. Tracy noticed that each of them was signed with the initials KC in a circle. The apartment smelled decidedly of cats, and there was a litter box in the bathroom that needed emptying. Three cats came mewling up to greet him. Short-haired tabby, a caramel-colored Persian mix, and a skinny Siamese. The fourth, a big fat black cat with white whiskers, a white blaze on its nose, and one white paw, regarded him with a regal indifference from atop the desk. There was no phone. Stormy was apparently not very big on housekeeping. Clothes were wadded up and piled here and there, their empty bottles on the old coffee table, and on the desk, the sink was full of dishes, and the ashtrays were full of cigarette butts. Tracy put down his rifle and went over to look inside the refrigerator. It held a dozen cans of Coors beer from the brewery in nearby Golden, a carton of milk, an open can of cat food, an empty, half-empty carton of eggs, a thoroughly wilted head of lettuce, a small tub of margarine, half a loaf of whole wheat bread, a large bag of marijuana, some apples, and some moldy cheese. There were more cosmetics in the bathroom than there was food in the refrigerator. What the hell, thought Tracy. He took out a can of beer, popped it open, and, for lack of anything better to do, started cleaning up. She took a complete stranger into her home, such as it was, and he figured the least he could do was wash the dishes and empty out the ashtrays. But nervous energy kept him going, and four beers later, he cleaned up the whole apartment. It wasn't quite up to the standards of a base inspection, but it was probably the cleanest it had ever been. Then, exhaustion finally claimed him, and he sank down into the futon with his rifle on the floor beside him, took his pistol out of its holster, put it by his side, pulled off his boots, and went to sleep. He was awakened several hours later by the sound of her key in the door. Two of the cats were curled up beside him. She came in wearing tight, faded jeans, running shoes, a sweatshirt, and a leather motorcycle jacket. She was carrying a bag of groceries. She used her back to shut the door.
You made it. Great. I didn't know if you'd be here, but I figured I'd pick up some food just in case, and holy shit.
What is it? He said, alarmed.
What the hell did you do?
I was feeling a little wired, so I thought I'd just clean up a bit. I hope you don't mind.
Mind? Are you kidding? Jesus, look at this place. It's spotless. You didn't have to go all through all this trouble.
He shrugged. You went to a lot of trouble for me. I don't know if I put everything away the way you like it. I sort of had to guess.
Wow, you even emptied the litter box. Jeez, you must think I'm a real slob.
No, I think you're a very nice person for helping me the way you did. You don't even know anything about me. You took a pretty big chance. I could have been some sort of freak or something.
She put the bag of groceries down on the kitchen table.
I don't think there was much of a chance of that. I can usually spot the bad ones. Believe me, I've had a lot of experience. You just seem like you were a nice guy who got himself in some trouble. But hey, you didn't have to do all of this.
It's no big deal. It helped me work up some nervous energy and get some sleep. I was dead on my feet. I really appreciate what you've done, Stormy. Thanks.
Karen.
What?
Karen. Stormy's just the name I dance under. My real name's Karen Carter. My friends call me KC.
You did those drawings?
Huh?
The sketches on the walls. I was looking at them. They're really very good.
Thank you.
She kicked off her shoes and sat down.
Somebody called the club and asked for you.
A woman?
No, some guy. You know anyone named Higgins?
Higgins?
Tracy frowned.
No.
Well, he seemed to know you.
Wait a minute,
Tracy said. He took a folded piece of paper out of his breast pocket. He unfolded it and looked at it.
Yeah, I know who he is. He's CIA.
CIA, she said. You got the CIA after you? Jesus, what did you do?
I tried to stop a military coup.
A what?
A military coup! That's when the army takes over control of the government.
You're kidding.
Believe me, I wish I was. Look, you took a big chance helping me the way you did, so I might as well tell you the whole story. You deserve to know what you've gotten yourself into.
She lit up a cigarette. She offered him the pack. He took one, and she lit it for him.
I was part of the unit set up to warn Air Force Base out in Cheyenne. Our job was supposed to be to deactivate the missile network out there.
There's still missiles up there? She said. I thought they were all launched during the war.
Not all of them. The virus killed some of the launch crews before they could complete their launch procedures. So there are still missiles up there, standing in their silos. We were supposed to crack open the silos and LCFs. That's the launch control facilities. They take an inventory and dismantle the remaining missiles. General Cord was placed in command of the operation since he's the area commander of the entire Northwest Sector. And some government scientists were sent out from back east to supervise the whole thing. Only Cord hasn't dismantled any of the missiles. He never intended to. Instead, he took the scientists prisoner and forced them to show him how to bring the missiles back online. Replace the burnt-out computer components, get the missiles operational again, and retarget them.
What for?
He's going to use them to blackmail the government into giving him commands. And then they turn the government over to him, or he drops a nuke on New York City.
My God, are you serious?
Deadly serious. I was on one of the details in charge of opening up the silos and the LCFs. I knew from the start something was screwy. Every time we opened up a silo or an LCF, a maintenance crew went down there and started checking out the systems and replacing parts. The official story was that they needed to get all the equipment operational again so they could check out the status of the missiles. But it just didn't ring true somehow. I couldn't see why they needed to get them back online just to dismantle the network. Why not just remove the warheads and take the goddamn things apart? And on top of that, Gord had several elite combat units floated, supposedly to provide additional security. But he already had the Cobra Force there, in addition to the regular troops. What the hell did he need Rangers and Delta Force for? It just didn't make sense. It's like he was expecting a war or something. And then, last night, while I was getting ready to go on guard duty, I ran into one of the scientists, a man named Dr. Franks. They were keeping him all under guard in one of the officers' mansions. Again, supposedly to provide them with security. But Franks told me what was really going on. Everything clicked right in. I knew he was telling me the truth. He'd escaped, and he was trying to get me off the base to warn the authorities. But the Cobras caught up to him and took him back. There wasn't anything I could do. I had tried to stop them. They would have shot me. One of them was dead. They were suspicious,
But I managed to convince them that Franks hadn't had a chance to tell me anything. And then, first chance I got, I went over the wall. I stole a truck in Cheyenne. I figured if I could make it to Denver before they found out I was gone, I could lose myself in the city and warn them.
Did you? She said. Warn them, I mean.
I tried. I got through to Linda Tellerman, the network newscaster. You know, the one who did all those stories on the cyborg. I was pretty sure I had convinced her. But then when the cops showed up at the club, I thought she'd given me away. But maybe she didn't. I tried to get back to my truck, but the truck I stole, and the cops were watching it. So maybe they just spotted it outside the club. And they might have got a report from that pawn shop where I knocked out hawked some of my gear. But Linda was supposed to call me back at the club, and she never did. Instead, this guy Higgins calls. I don't know what that means. She said he was the one who contacted her with the information I gave her, and she gave me his number, but she also said she didn't tell him where I was. And the only way he could have known that was if she told them. So I don't know what the hell to think now.
Wow, said KC. So the cops were after you because you deserted and you stole a truck. Hell, that's not so bad. Sounds like me. You had one of a hell of a good reason. And it's not as if you killed anybody or anything like that.
Tracy looked at her and compressed his lips tightly.
Only I did. At least two people. Maybe more. I don't know.
You don't know?
They sent a chopper out to intercept me on the way to Denver. That caught up to me outside Loveland. I had to shoot it down. I don't know how many people were aboard. At least two. Maybe more.
You shut down an army helicopter? She said with disbelief. She glanced at his battle rifle. With that?
No, with my rocket launcher. I sold it to the pawn shop to get some money. I didn't have any on me when I left. Actually, to be perfectly honest, what I did was rob the pawn shop. The guy figured I was AWOL, and he tried to rook me on the deal. So I held him up and cleaned out his cash register. About $600. But I left him the rocket launcher, the backpack computer, and my battle helmet. He came out way ahead on the deal, but that doesn't change the fact that I held him up at gunpoint. So I'm not only a deserter, I'm also a car thief, an armed robber, and a murderer. And by coming here, I'm afraid I've made you an accessory.
What would have happened if you hadn't shot down that helicopter?
They would have killed me, or arrested me, or taken me back, which would have amounted to the same thing, I guess. I would have been court-martialed and shot, probably.
So it was self-defense, then.
Tracy made a sound halfway between a snort and a laugh.
Somehow, I don't think the police would see it that way.
Well, I don't give a shit how the police would see it. That's how it looks to me. You stole the car because you had to. And you could have just held up the pawn shop without leaving your stuff there. Like you said, it's not like the guy lost out on the deal. That stuff must be worth a hell of a lot more than a lousy $600.
But it wasn't mine to sell,
he said.
Who cares? Look, what are you beating yourself up over the head for? From what you've told me, it sounds like you're a hero, not a criminal, for Christ's sakes.
Tracy grimaced.
Somehow, I'm not feeling very heroic at this moment. What I feel is scared.
Well, believe me, I know what it feels like, she said. But you should be pretty safe here. Nobody knows you're here except Debbie and Sherry, and they won't say anything. They're friends of mine, and cops aren't exactly their favorite people.
Yeah, maybe not. But what if there's a reward out? I mean, I don't want to say anything against your friends. But people can be tempted, you know?
Depends on who's doing the tempting, she said. Sherry's boyfriend was shot down by the cops, and Debbie served some time for dealing. Believe me, even if there was a reward, they wouldn't turn you in. Snitch is a dirty word in this part of town. Besides, I think Debbie kind of likes you.
Tracy blushed.
Yeah, well, about what happened with Debbie. I don't really know what to say.
So you went down on her. What's wrong with that? Knowing her, she probably got turned on with the cops questioning her about you, and you right there between her legs.
She giggled.
Jesus, you're actually blushing. You're so damn straight, I can't believe it.
Tracy blushed again and looked away.
I feel like a damn idiot.
Come on, you're just a nice guy who got in way over his head.
She giggled at her unintentional pun,
in more ways than one.
Look, I'm grateful for everything you've done, said Tracy. But maybe I should just get out of here. I've already involved you way too much. I don't want to see you get in trouble on my account.
Are you kidding? Some whacked-out general is getting ready to drop a bomb on New York City and kill God knows how many people, and you're worried about one exotic dancer? Come on, get serious. Besides, where the hell would you go?
I've got some money.
Yeah, and in this neighborhood, how long do you think you'll keep it?
I'm not exactly unprotected, you know. He patted his battle rifle. And I've got my pistol, my knife, and plenty of ammunition.
Sure. And you'll check into some sleazy strip motel, and the manager will make a call, let the creeps in with his pass key, and they'll plug you while you're sleeping. Or some gang sniper will take you out. Walking around with that thing is a sure invitation to get yourself trashed.
I may seem a bit naive to you, said Tracy defensively, but I've been in combat, you know. I can take care of myself.
Honey, being in combat's one thing, but you're on the Denver Strip now. And no offense, but you're a real babe in the woods. Besides, you think you can lay off all that stuff on me and just leave? Forget about it. You've got to do something.
Look, don't think I'm ungrateful, but I can't think what I can accomplish just by staying here.
You can stay alive for one thing. The cops are looking for you, but they're not looking for me, and this is my turf. I know it like the back of my hand. You can do a lot more with me than without me, so just knock off this I don't want you to get you into any trouble routine. I've been in trouble all my life. Now it's the first thing we got to do is find out what the story is with the news reporter you've been in touch with, and then we'll find out what the deal is with this Higgins guy. After that, I'll make a couple of calls. I might know some people who can help you, but first we got to get some food into you. You look like you're about ready to pass out.
Tracy grimaced.
I already did.
Well, you cleaned up the place. The least I can do is make you dinner. You like chili?
I love it.
Hot?
The hotter the better.
Hey, a man after my own heart. I'll make us some dinner, but first, what say we crack open a couple of brews and break out the bong to help work up our appetites?
Break out the bong. She got up and went over to the fridge. She took out the bag of grass.
That's marijuana, isn't it?
Said Tracy. She stared at him.
You're putting me on.
Yeah, well, that's what I figured it was.
Oh, wow. You mean to tell me you've never got high?
Well, I've been drunk a few times.
She rolled her eyes.
My God, I've got a virgin on my hands.
She went over to the desk and picked up a plastic bong pipe, then came over to sit on the futon beside him.
Don't worry. You're not going to hallucinate or anything, but you might feel a little silly. It affects some people that way.
He watched as she prepared the pipe and lit it. She placed her mouth over the bong and inhaled deeply, held it, then let it out in a heavy exhalation.
Okay, now, just like I did, she said, passing him the pipe.
He copied her, but he was unprepared for the harshness of the smoke. He started coughing. She chuckled.
It's okay. You'll get used to it. It'll help you relax. After what you've been through, you need to mellow out a little.
They passed the bong back and forth a few times. Then she looked at him and smiled.
Feeling it yet?
A little.
Open your mouth.
What?
Open your mouth. I'm going to supercharge you.
He opened his mouth. She took a deep drag on the bong. Then, holding it, she leaned over, put her arm around him, and placing her mouth up against his, she exhaled into him. He felt her warm breath and the hot smoke fill up his lungs.
I'm feeling a little lightheaded, he said.
That's the whole idea. She put down the pipe. Don't want to overdo it the first time.
He blinked.
Woo!
She smiled.
Come here.
She cupped her hands around his face and kissed him very lightly, then ran her tongue over his lips. She moved against him, her tongue slipping into his mouth. He brought his hand up to caress her breast. She took his wrist and he hesitated. He started to apologize, but she smiled and slipped his hand inside her sweatshirt. She wasn't wearing a bra. She kissed him again as he fondled her. She reached down between his legs.
You have done this before, haven't you?
Yeah, once or twice.
Mmm,
she said, undoing his trousers. She lowered her head to his lap.
Oh, Jesus,
he said, leaning back and shutting his eyes. A few moments later, she stopped, got up and took off her sweatshirt, then peeled off her jeans. She wasn't wearing any panties, and she was a natural blonde.
Oh, God,
he said, his eyes glazed.
You're so beautiful.
She grinned.
And you're so stoned.
She pushed him back and back down onto the futon. Lordy, lordy, lordy. Okay. The X-Wing came in low over the town of Montauk, out on the southeastern tip of Long Island. They had flown in at close to the speed of sound over long stretches of deserted southern Long Island countryside, broken up here and there by tiny settlements. They followed the old Sunrise Expressway, and as they approached the Hamptons, near where the eastern end of Long Island split into two fin-like projections separated by the Great Peconic Bay, they dropped their airspeed down below 200 miles per hour. As the graphite fiber X-Wing switched from fixed wing to rotary blade mode, the craft reverted from a jet back into a helicopter once again. It passed over the sprawling agro communes operated by the Brood, farm settlements that did not supply the city but fed the villages governed by the Brood enclave, and sold their produce to the other outlaw enclaves on the island and to freebooters plying the Atlantic coast. The towns of West Hampton, Hampton Bay, South Hampton, Bridgehampton, and East Hampton, collectively referred to as the Hamptons, had at one time been the summer playground of the city's wealthy celebrities and literati, where would-be F. Scott Fitzgeralds rubbed elbows with movie stars and rock musicians. Now there were once more sleepy little seacoast towns and fishing villages, home to those super survivors of the bio war who had gone to the Brood to seek protection from the scavengers and raiders who found shelter in the island's many ghost towns. Steele had requested a data download on the Brood before he had left, and Dr. Stone had gotten it together for him while he was meeting ICE. As they flew out toward Montauk in the X-Wing, Jennifer contacted him through the broadcast link and fed the information to him. The Brotherhood, as they were sometimes referred to themselves, was originally formed sometime after the bio war, when the surviving members of several large outlaw motorcycle clubs from the tri-state area banded together to form the Brood. Their colors were black leather vests emblazoned with a grinning death's head with long blonde hair and an Uncle Sam top hat worn at a rakish angle. Above it was a white rocker with Brood embroidered on it in red letters. Below it, a similar rocker bearing the words Long Island. On either side of the skull were two smaller patches, one with the letter M, the other with the letter C. On closer inspection, one could see small nuclear mushroom clouds in the death's head's eyes sockets. The term Outlaw Motorcycle Club apparently did not originally refer to outlaws in the commonly accepted definition of the term. In the days after World War II, a number of loosely organized biker clubs sprang up, perhaps the most famous originating with a group of freewheeling veterans who adopted the name of their former combat squadron, the Hell's Angels. The American Motorcycle Association, the body that sanctioned racing events that were, up to that time, the chief focus of organized biker activity, did not approve of these raucous, hard-drinking, brawling hellraisers who attended their functions and consequently branded them as outlaws, meaning that they had no respect for that organization's bylaws and, conscious of its public image, referred to them as only 1% of the motorcycling enthusiast population. Whereupon, the clubs were proudly started to refer to themselves as outlaws and one percenters. According to the file, if their lifestyle and image in later years could be pinned down to one event, it would have been a famous raid on the small town of Hollister, Texas, an incident that was greatly exaggerated in the press and exaggerated even further in the Hollywood film based on that event, The Wild One, starring Marlon Brando. Real bikers considered Lee Marvin to be the one true star of that film, for his authentic portrayal of a boozing, two-fisted one percenter, but it was Brando with his sultry good looks and jaunty cap who received all the attention in his star-making role as the leather-jacketed leader of the fictional Black Rebels Motorcycle Club. He didn't even ride a Harley, but a Triumph, which real one percenters conceded was a motorcycle, but just barely. That film, more than anything else, firmly established the image of the outlaw motorcycle gang in the public's mind. Lock the doors, call the state police, and hide your daughters. Here come the outlaw bikers to take over your town. People expected the worst from one percenters after that, and perversely, the one percenters gave it to them. In the Brood's case, they had literally taken over not one, but several towns, and the beleaguered citizens were only too glad to have them do so. Few of the current members of the Brotherhood had even heard of Marlon Brando, much less the Wild One. That had been long before their time. But they had a long tradition on which to draw, and those modern motorcycle outlaws were outlaws in every sense of the term, at least insofar as the government was concerned, since they recognized absolutely no authority outside their own. It took a lot more than a motorcycle and a leather jacket to be a member of the Brood. In their own way, they were as much of an elite as were the Cobras and the Delta Force. A prospect had to prove himself over a period of time. Never herself. The Brood had women, but they weren't an equal opportunity organization. Women could belong, but only as defined by marriage or an intimate relationship. On their colors, they were small patches identifying them as the property of a particular member. And what had time spent as a prospect could make indentured servitude seem like an attractive lifestyle. In the years since they had established their enclave, the Brood had brought law and order to their part of the island. Their law and their order, but it was enforced with draconian effectiveness. But they had also brought a measure of stability and prosperity to the citizens who resided in their towns and agro communes. Life in the Brood Enclave was, in many ways, much safer than in Midtown, and it was immeasurably preferable to life in Midtown's no man's land. There wasn't a raider or a screamer within miles of their turf, and anyone who broke their laws was dealt with quickly, effectively, and often permanently. They did business with the freebooters and the mob enclaves to the west, who kept them supplied with precious fuel and various other commodities that they could not produce in their machine shops. They maintained fishing fleets, a power plant, manufacturing facilities, and even a small hospital. In short, they were essentially autonomous. They wanted nothing from the government, and since they posed no threat to it and ran no criminal operations in the city, as did the mobs, the government left them alone and asked nothing from them, except this time. The X-Wing slowed as it approached the town of Montauk, the headquarters of the Brood Enclave. Word of their approach had already reached the headquarters, and the pilot, his head totally encased and enclosed inside his VCASS helmet, indicated a spot below them, where a large number of bikes formed a circle in an open area, defining an LZ. The message was quite clear. Land here. Steele glanced at the pilot and nodded. They sat down inside the circle of bikes, and as the rotors slowed, the pilot turned to Steele and asked, You think this'll take long?
I hope not, Steele said. I haven't got the luxury of time.
I'll stay with the chopper then. My luck, one of these jokers know how to fly this thing, and they might decide they want an Air Force. Steele grinned.
If they decide that, you being here is not going to stop them.
Maybe not, but it might discourage them a little, said the pilot, patting his machine pistol.
Just don't get nervous, Steele said. If they get the idea that you're tense, they might try to push you, so stay cool.
You got it. Steele left the chopper, ducking to avoid the rotating blades as they slowed. The graphite fiber blades were rigid, and they weren't supposed to flex and droop like standard blades, but he wasn't taking any chances. He still remembered the time an overeager strike force trainee of considerably more than an average height disembarked fully upright from a chopper in a training exercise. Fortunately, the blades had slowed enough that his mistake was not a lethal one, but one of the drooping blades beamed him in the back of his battle helmet, and he went down like a felled tree. After that, every time he got out of a chopper, he looked like he was crawling through a mine tunnel. Three of the motorcycles roared up to meet them, a Harley Sport Glide and two ratty Honda Hurricanes, looking like gutted Mixmasters with all the plastic aerodynamic bodywork removed. Without the sleek wraparound bodywork, there were ugly-looking machines, wires, cables, and oil lines hanging out all over the place. In the old days, one percenters would sooner chug-a-lug spittoons than ride on Japanese machinery, which they refer to contemptuously as rice grinders. I don't even think that's accurate. But in these hard times, good wheels were hard to come by. Consequently, the old Harley-Davidsons, regardless of condition, were symbols of serious status. The Harley that pulled up to him was stripped down and more closely resembled a two-wheeled tractor. What with its lack of a windshield and front fender, its frame-hugging seat and homemade components to replace worn-out original parts, but its straight pipes gave stentorian testimony to the motor's soundness, and every square inch of the beautiful, bored, and stroked V-twin engine had been lovingly cleaned and polished. The large 5-gallon gas tank was painted a deep midnight blue, with almost photographically perfect Colt single-action army revolvers rendered on its sides. Steele recognized the hulking rider. He was known as Peacemaker, the club's sergeant-at-arms. They'd never met before, but Steele had seen him interviewed on a television talk show about the outlaw enclaves on Long Island. See Steele 1 for more details. The Harley-Davidson rode up to him and slid to a stop with its front wheel about an inch from Steele's kneecap. Steele stood his ground and didn't flinch, as he was undoubtedly intended to. The giant biker regarded him steadily for a long moment, taking him in. Steele, in turn, took the biker's measure. He must have weighed in close to 300 pounds, with a huge beer gut and arms like tree trunks, festooned with intricate tattoos. His hair hung well below his shoulders, and his full beard came right down to his chest. He looked like a Viking. He had heavy rings on all four fingers of each hand, which probably gave his fists the effect of knuckle dusters in a fight, and he wore gold earrings in both ears, as well as one in his nose, like a prize bull.
What happens when you have to blow your nose? Asked Steele,
pleasantly. In reply, the Micro made a loud snorting noise and hawked a huge lung. I think it's supposed to be loogie, but it says lunger. A huge lunger onto Steele's boot. Steele glanced down at it and looked up at the outlaw and smiled. He then reached down quickly, stuck his fingers through the front wheel spokes, grabbing it by the rim, and lifted the entire front end one-handed, dumping the startled biker on his ass. Instantly, an entire battery of guns was pointed at him. Steele paid no attention. As the biker sat on the ground, staring at him in disbelief, Steele carefully lowered the big Harley, steadied it by its handlebar, and put down the kickstand. Then he bent over and blew an imaginary speck of dust off the gas tank. For a moment, there was total silence. Then Peacemaker started to laugh, a big, booming, raucous, "Ho, ho, ho!" that immediately broke the tension. Back inside the chopper, the pilot rolled his eyes and exhaled heavily.
"Fucking A!"
the outlaw said.
"Only one man could have done that! You're Donovan Steele, aren't you?" "That's me."
The biker got up and held out his hand.
"Peacemaker, Sergeant at Arms."
Steele gave him the biker's handshake.
"Put him away, boys,"
Peacemaker said to the others.
This here's one bad motherfucker." "Nice scooter,"
said Steele.
"Yeah, thanks for not dropping it. If you had, we would have had to dance. Don't think I would have enjoyed that much."
He grinned.
"So, what does the man want with the Brotherhood?" "Not the man," said Steele. "Me. The man's behind me, but this was my idea. I need to talk some business with your president, and it happens to be real urgent. Can you call a war council?"
Peacemaker frowned.
"A war council? You know what that means?" "Yes, I know. Can we do it right away?" "Damn, what the hell have you got on your mind?" "I'll make a deal with you," Steele said. "You set it up within 15 minutes, and I'll get you one of those."
He pointed at the gun painted on the Harley's gas tank.
"A Peacemaker? You're shitting me?" "An authentic Colt 45, a single action army, not a replica. You know where I know where I can get one, with genuine ivory grips." "Fucking A, man! You got a deal! Hop aboard!"
10 minutes later, Steele was sitting in the clubhouse bar surrounded by 10 very serious members of the Brood War Council. He laid it out for them, then waited for the reaction. Snake, the club president, sat with his booted feet up on the table, smoking a cigarette. He was as long and lean as his namesake, clean-shaven, with deeply sunken pink eyes, hollow cheeks, and a long knife scar on his face. He was anywhere from 30 to 50 years old, and it was impossible to tell. He was an albino, with long, snow-white hair that hung straight down to the middle of his back. With his skin stretched out taut across his features, he resembled the death's head on the club colors. He was very soft-spoken, with a cool, no-nonsense manner, and the most penetrating direct stare that Steele had ever seen.
"Let me get this straight," he said softly. The room was utterly silent. "This General Cord said he wants to set himself up as military dictator, and if the man doesn't buckle under, he starts launching nukes?"
"That's right. We got less than 72 hours to meet his terms, so I'm in no position to haggle. Name your terms, I'll meet them. Cash, drugs, ordnance, whatever. Half payable up front, half later, assuming there's an after."
Snake stared at him for a long moment without saying anything.
"You want us to take on the Cobra Force, huh?"
"That's right, and I need an answer now. Want me to leave the room while you discuss it?"
"America under martial law?"
After a long silence, then Snake addressed the others without shifting his glance from Steele.
"We got anything to discuss, people?"
"Fuck no, man! Do it! Waste the bastards! Yeah, let's party!"
"You got your answer, Steele," Snake said.
"Thanks! I owe you guys! What are your terms?"
"We don't want nothing from the man," said Snake. "We take the man's pay. That means we're working for the man, and we don't work for nobody."
Steele stared at him with astonishment.
"There's going to be heavy losses. You tell me you don't want anything?"
"Yeah, I want something," Snake said. "You ride?"
"Yeah, I can ride a bike."
Snake stood up and removed his colors, then tossed him on the table before Steele.
"When we go in, wear that."
Steele picked up the leather vest emblazoned with the club colors and Snake's name.
"I know what these mean to you people," he said. "Why, I haven't done anything to earn it."
"I appreciate that," Snake said.
The angels used to have a saying, when we do right, no one remembers. When we do wrong, no one forgets. He smiled. You're famous, man. We ride against the Cobra Force with a cyborg flying our colors. Ain't no one gonna forget.
Steel stood up and solemnly put on the colors.
It'll be an honor.
They shook, then Snake turned to the others.
Okay, spread the word. We ride.
End of chapter.